I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, are you prepared for the end of the world? Because it's coming, apparently, according to some people.
Oh, right, the Mayan calendar thing.
Yeah, there's the Mayan calendar thing that says basically this December the world's going to end. Then we have, of course, the rapture predictions.
Right.
Predictions that hold that the world will have actually ended by the time this publishes. So I don't know if this will this may publish in a post-rapture world.
Well, I guess you haven't seen my bumper sticker over here.
What does it say?
That when the rapture comes, this podcast booth will be evacuated.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, it's true.
I mean, it's been hanging here for like a year.
We won't be here because I can't do it by myself. I'm sticking around. I've actually ordered a rapture-proof suit over the internet. Mm-hmm. It's like lined with lead and heretical bubble wrap. Each bubble in the bubble wrap contains a tiny occultist icon that helps protect my soul from leaving my body in the case of the rapture. This way I can stick around and document the events.
Yeah, I think that's probably going to work.
Just in case. And if it doesn't happen, well, then I just spent a lot of money on a weird suit. Wouldn't be the first time.
You wouldn't be the first person either, right? Turns out that the end days have been a concept that that predate Christ, right? Because we typically when we talk about end days or the rapture, apocalypse, we usually think about it being mired in religion, this concept.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty – I mean, the whole Book of Revelations thing and all its crazy imagery, I mean, that's certainly and to Western audiences is the predominant idea. Like I remember growing up in – when my family lived up in Newfoundland, Canada, we attended this small church. I remember the preacher talking one day about like the end times were going to come.
Mm-hmm.
There was going to be this huge war between the forces of good and evil, and we would be called upon to fight in that war. And I remember being really thrown back by that. And after church, I was asking my mom and dad, I was like, is that for real? Are we going to have to, am I going to have to battle in this war?
Am I going to just suit up or what?
Yeah, it sounds kind of awful. I'd rather not do that. And they were like, don't worry about that.
So, were they like, it's a metaphor?
No, they were just kind of like, don't worry about that.
Yeah, it's probably not going to happen. Okay, so, all right. Obviously, today we're talking about apocalypse.
Yes.
The many apocalypses that have come and gone. It never actually occurred, right? And we're actually going to talk about...
Or have they, right?
Right. Well, who knows? Who knows? A la Matrix, we're just like hooked up to some sort of alien apocalypse right now.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get into some of these ideas too, because in many cases, the apocalypse prediction doesn't come to pass, but that doesn't mean people give up on that prediction.
Yes.
So we'll get into exactly how that works on a cognitive level.
Yep, yep. But we should also talk about the apocalypse. It's not just in terms of, okay, this the religious thing that we think about, but also asteroids, nuclear winters,
yes.
You know, natural phenomena that happens, and people will sit there and say, ah, okay, this must be a sign. Right. And this has been happening forever since there have been humans.
Right. Right. There are a number of different apocalyptic scenarios. You, of course, have the spiritual ones, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
There are cosmological ones, some of which have a little more validity than others, like the idea of a meteor or comet hitting the Earth and causing extreme damage, wiping out civilizations.
Right.
Obviously, that has occurred before in the past, not within human history, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, nothing on a scale enough to wipe us out as a species. But that is, it's a possibility. Unlike some of the other weirder things that are ideas that have populated on the internet, such as like Planet X colliding with Earth,
right.
Planetary alignment scenarios that end up, you know, wiping everything off the face of the planet. Things of that nature are a lot more far-fetched, but are at least based in actual science at some level,
yeah.
You know, exaggerated. Yeah. And then there are, of course, economic predictions.
Right.
You don't have to go far to tune into some economic doom and gloom these days. And granted, economists predicting the future of global economies is a far different kettle of fish than a guy in the street corner telling you about when the demonic or UFO invasion is happening.
Right.
But still, it's very much a prediction of things going really, really bad in a very catastrophic manner with dire consequences that people will buy into with their fear.
Well, and I think that we can't help but look over our shoulder and see what might be coming at us or try to predict that. And I was just thinking about the panel that I heard on cryptography. And
this is at the World
Science
Festival.
Thank mm-hmm. you. Yeah. And the guy was a retired, I don't know if he was CIA, but he was sitting there saying, this is actually a really big issue, the security issue online, because if certain people wanted to, they could bring down the U.S. economy and they could basically like close down the grid, close down the economy, and we would have something like 30 days where we could exist in a sort of peaceful manner before all hell broke loose and you know, civilization just sort of collapsed on itself. So you hear this.
Right.
You know, and it's not just this guy. It's just even someone like, say, Stephen Hawking, right, who couldn't help but say, you know, hey, I'm going to sound the alarm here. Quit talking to the aliens.
Yes. Because if they're anything like us.
Yeah. If they're anything like us.
They're jerks.
They're jerks. You know, they're really into hierarchies. And B, you know, if they do exist, they're probably much more complex than we are and advanced. So what will that lead to? Our doom.
Yeah, Jeff Goldblum and Will Smith are not going to be able to fly up there and just stick a disc in the mothership to shut it all down. It's going to be a far different situation. Yeah, technology has played a part in a number of predictions. There's, of course, the Y2K.
That's right.
A situation that did not come to pass, but that had people heading for the hills and
stocking up on water.
Yeah, stocking up on water and beans. If you have a chance, check out the HowStuffWorks.com's article, 2012 Apocalypse Survival Guide. That's one I wrote that kind of humorously takes you through 10 of the sort of out there, in many cases, scenarios for how the world is going to end this December. Yeah. And some of those are like,
that's pretty great.
Yeah, there's one based in computer programs trying to predict the course of events and people claiming that these computers have dictated exactly when the world is going to end and it lines
right.
up in 2012, you know. So yeah,
and we just got a clue and, you know,
right.
got an inkling of what they were up to.
Yeah. So you know, technological, economic, spiritual, political. I mean, there's any kind of movement or system that is big enough to fail with dire consequences, people are and have been predicting failure for ages.
Yeah. And before we talk about some good examples of apocalypses or you know, in the past that people have thought would come to pass, let's talk a little bit why we're hardwired to like a really good apocalypse story. Why does it appeal to us?
Yeah, because obviously we keep doing these mental circles for a reason. And
right.
it's because our brains are central to it.
Yeah. And there's this in this story of the apocalypse, there is a promise of renewal, right?
In many of them, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like the phoenix from the flame. It's an impetus to right our wrongs, right? And there's a moral code in some of these which says that, you know, if I live my life right, then it's a rapture. You know, I will be spared from the scorched earth. And speaking of scorched earth, I mean, you know, if you're talking in secular terms, you could even say that in something like the military, which has scorched earth policies sometimes and applied to warfare, if you take a country down, a community down to the studs, you're scorching the earth. There's this idea that you can then fill that void with a renewal for these people.
Yeah.
Right. Besides dominating them. To a certain degree. So, I mean, you see it in all different areas. But again, it is a sort of a cathartic experience. And I think that that's why people are, gravitate to it so much, or some people do.
Yeah. So many of these systems involve a system that is flawed to its core, ultimately mm-hmm. fails. And when it fails, that gives us the room to create a new system. Be that, you know, typically we're talking about a civilization. It's like humans for ages realizing that the systems they create or the systems they inhabit are not quite perfect or not completely to their liking.
Yeah.
And surely if this system were to run its course and have enough rope to hang itself, we'd be able to build some new system that obviously wouldn't be horrible.
Well, to your point, Isaac Asimov's Book of Facts actually talks about an Assyrian clay tablet that dates back to 2800 BC. And it was unearthed, and it bears the words, "Our earth is degenerate in these latter days. There are signs that the world is speedily coming to an end. Bribery and corruption are common."
Oh, wow.
Okay, so 2800 BC, mm-hmm. people are like, you know what? This is this planet, this thing that's going on here on Earth. It's just not working out. Surely it will end.
Surely the second coming is at hand, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's just one example of, you know, perception of moral decay in society. But, you know, there are a ton of them. Romans saw the AD 79 eruption of Mount Vesuvius as a sign that society was about to get its kick in the pants when Pompeii went up in smoke. Or excuse me, when Pompeii was actually buried in smoke.
As Yeats said again, it's no country for old men, right? People are always looking at the world around them and seeing forces that are a danger to them rising up and systems that are not working all around them.
And patterns, always patterns,
patterns,
right?
Yeah, because our brains, as we've discussed before, are all about finding patterns. We have to navigate this world of fixed and movable objects, of symbols, of information, of social systems. Mm-hmm. And we have to navigate all of this. So we need a brain. We've evolved to have a brain that is ideal for surviving this environment.
Well, and also think about Halley's Comet, right? This is another example, something happening, getting a lot of press, and people not quite understanding what they think the impact will be. Halley's Comet, oh my goodness, 1910. People believe that the comet's tail contained a gas that would impregnate the atmosphere and possibly snuff out all life on planet
Whoa.
Earth. And they began to sell like all sorts of goofy little relics to help people survive this event.
Oh, wow.
You know, so again, yes, people, you can't help it, right? It depends on how much you know about an event.
And then later we have Heaven's Gate.
Right, Heaven's Gate.
Who believe that the comet is actually signals that the UFO is coming to take us away, or at least take this small selection of believers away.
Right, which had a very, very sad ending, right?
Yes.
I mean, this is the case where they actually all poisoned themselves, is that right?
Yeah, they all committed suicide.
Yeah.
And the leader, he also had himself surgically castrated. I don't know why that was a prerequisite for the alien ship, but, you know. Dude had some issues.
Seriously. It's not funny, but goodness gracious.
But,
another good example is the Seekers, right? Going back to aliens.
Yeah, the Seekers are quite an interesting story. This was a small Chicago area cult. Whose members thought that they were communicating with aliens, specifically communicating with Sananda, who they believed was the a cosmic incarnation of Jesus. And the leader in all this was this lady, Dorothy Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was basically a housewife.
Mm-hmm.
She was not, you know, there's nothing really spectacular about her life up until this point. But then she picked up a little theosophy. She picked up a little Scientology.
Mm-hmm. She was all about the Dianetics, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then, by the way, theosophy is kind of like a founded in 1875. It's kind of a combination of some elements of Buddhism and Brahmanism and some reincarnation thrown in with some spiritual evolution.
Yeah. And there's some spinoffs, right? Like the Baha'i faith.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I don't think that they subscribe to aliens.
No, I'm not sure. I know Rainn Wilson is one.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh, okay.
Yeah, he has a really cool site called Soul Pancake, I believe. And it's all about like reaching young audiences, getting them talking and discussing like spiritual ideas. It's kind of neat. But anyway, so Dorothy Martin, 54 years old, Oak Park, and she, suddenly she starts communicating with these aliens. And she learns from them, she says, that December 21st, 1954 is the day that the seas are going to rise, the continent's going to split, and flying saucers are going to swoop down to the rescue of her and the believers. And it was even to the point where everybody like gathered for this. People were removing zippers from their garments and getting
out of
rid
their bras, by the way.
Yeah. Removing the wire from their bras because supposedly that would interfere with the spaceship. Or perhaps it would just slow your journey down as you tried to make it through security to board the spaceship.
She divined this, by the way, from automatic writing.
Ooh.
Which I thought was kind of funny because that's sort of old fashioned to me. Like that to me, that's like the St. Lance's and turn of the century sort of kind of like table raising gig.
So obviously the date came and went and everyone was still here. The world was still continuing all around them. And they kind of faced a crisis of faith here. What do you do when you've come to believe that the world is going to end, when you've invested, when you've done stuff like said, well, I'm never going to have to pay this credit card off, or, well, I'm not going to need a car again. I'm going to sell that and support this this group or cult that I'm that I've become a part of.
Yeah, and you've become really committed.
Yeah, you're committed to this idea, if not completely, then substantially. And then when this core part of your belief system fails on you, what do you do?
Well, we're going to take a quick break and we'll find out what you do.
This podcast is brought to you by Intel, the sponsors of tomorrow, and the Discovery Channel. At Intel, we believe curiosity is the spark which drives innovation. Join us at curiosity.com and explore the answers to life's questions.
All right, we're back, just like we said we would. That was not a false prediction at all.
No. Came to pass.
As the prophecy foretold, we have returned. And we are going to discuss the question of what happens when you predict something, ideally the end of the world or some sort of major spiritual reckoning. What happens when you predict it and it doesn't come to pass?
Well, wouldn't you say, oh my goodness, this was all, you know, ballyhoo. This was a mistake. I need to reassess my life and perhaps get my job back. Wouldn't that be sort of the logical conclusion?
Well, that would be the logical. But like we said, you've already invested a lot in this idea.
And, yeah, I've quit my job. I've sold my car.
Yeah. And as this was happening, though, with the Seekers back in the 50s, they were out there preaching the message. They really believed this. They were not trying to hoard the afterlife and redemption and aboard the UFO. They were not hoarding those seats for themselves. Apparently, there was plenty of seating available.
Right.
And so they were spreading the word. And one individual that heard this and was particularly fascinated was a Stanford University psychologist, Leon Festinger. And so he and some of his colleagues decided to infiltrate the group.
Which I love. This is great, right? Because how else are you going to be able to observe people who, you know, what passes over their face when December 21st comes and goes?
Yeah. I mean, on another level, it's kind of jerky, you know, because it's like you're kind of
messing with them.
You're your way into their midst and saying that you believe what they believe. I mean, it's like if you, you know, started going to sports games with somebody and then you're really getting into them, into the game, and you're like, oh yeah, go Falcons or whatever. And then finally they were like, actually, I don't really like the Falcons, but I've been studying you this whole time.
Yes, you're right.
But at any rate,
from a research perspective.
From a research perspective, this was an irresistible situation.
It's the real deal.
Yeah, it gave them the chance to infiltrate this group, study from the inside how they were thinking about the end of the world, and then study how they behaved once their prediction did not come to pass.
Yeah, and so Festinger found something out that was pretty fascinating, that when this did come to pass, well, first of all, Dorothy Martin started writing again really quickly, right, we assume, with her automatic writing, and she received a message that said, hey, wow, the aliens have spared Earth because we are so committed that they decided, you know, never mind, we're not going to destroy you, which sort of restored people's faith in what was going on, right?
I thought the message was going to be the aliens saying, hey, we hit traffic, so we're going to be a little late. You guys just hold.
Someone has metal on. Take it off. It's totally slowing down our arrival here. But that's what was so amazing about that people would double down on their beliefs in the face of data that was basically telling them that their belief system was wrong.
Yeah, because again, you've already invested so much in it. Are you just going to give up? It's the podcast that we're recording right after this one is going to deal with sports fandom. And as I can't help but wonder if it's a similar case. Like, what do you do when you believe in a sports team? Absolutely. And you support them. And then they fail on you. And they fail on you again and again and again.
Well, and I know we're not doing that podcast right now, but I will tell you that a lot of times people will blame it on bad luck or on the other team, or instead of actually looking at the raw data and saying, oh, my team is not so good. So you can't help but seek out some sort of explanation that squares with your idea, your original idea. And that's what Festinger based cognitive dissonance on, correct?
Correct. Well, it reminds one of the situation with Harold Camping, the current big rapture scenario that of course had a lot of play in the summer.
This was May 21st, right?
Yes. And of course it didn't happen, but he immediately said, well, let me revise. I've done the math again. And actually, yes, this date was correct, but it was a spiritual judgment and not like the actual judgment. So it was like the file was settled and stamped by heavenly authorities, and then the actual apocalypse was scheduled.
It was just an exploratory committee.
Right. They had completed
their
findings.
On the apocalypse.
Yeah.
Okay.
But basically, he's in one swoop, he's quantifying what has already happened and is not backing down from his previous claim, but he's also excusing away the fact that the world didn't end, and he's bumping that date up to when it will supposedly actually end, which of course he had done in the past. I mean, unfortunately for him, they didn't get as many contributions after that point. They've received less money from their supporters, but they still have supporters, and of course this guy still supports the idea completely. But yeah, even in the face of the original prediction not coming true, they've simply doubled down. Revised it a little, and apparently this is common too. When an end of the world event does not come to pass, it's spiritualized. So it's suddenly, oh, it didn't take place in the real world, but it took place in a spiritual means, or there's some sort of other message. So you come up with ways to reinterpret what has happened so that the movement can continue. And in some cases, you end up splitting off and becoming, you know, the followers end up having to really shift gears and become a slightly different faith.
Right, which again, I always think that it's interesting, this concept that we are creating our reality every single second, right? And it's all just our individual perception. So yes, there are some things that are constants, like the stars and the moon and the sky, but how you interpret what happens underneath the sky is completely up to that individual. And there was another thing that I read too about cognitive dissonance, and they were actually saying that, you know, apocalyptic thinking is not unlike people who are skeptical of global warming or people who are very ardent about the existence of global warming. And that the problem here is not that people don't have the right data. It's that it's being framed from a values perspective and not a data perspective.
Yeah, you end up with emotions intertwined in there.
Yeah.
And reasoning ends up intertwined with that emotion. Even something like global warming comes down to you end up with the emotional political ideas fueling the end of that. Personal feelings of guilt or responsibility become a part of that as well. And just to recap, cognitive dissonance, which we've covered in the past, this is a situation in the mind that arises when there's conflict between two opposing thoughts or between expectations and reality. As we've covered before, a really good example of two opposing thoughts would be if you completely held the belief that, say, homosexual impulses were sinful, but then you felt homosexual impulses. Like
right.
The two ideas are really conflict one another.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you end up with this cognitive dissonance where the thing you believe is not the thing that you believe? And then when it comes to expectations and reality, that is like the situation we're talking about here. It's kind of like if an individual sets out to become a rock star and doesn't become a rock star, their expectations and their reality are clashing. So they end up with this cognitive dissonance, and this is the situation with someone who thinks the world is going to end and then it doesn't. And the classic example is that we keep coming back around to is, you know, primordial ancestor in the bush, you know, walking around in the jungle. There are predators or enemies around, and then there's a sound in the bushes. Now, this could be one of two things. Basically, you can break it down to either that sound in the bushes that is a threat, a real threat, or it's nothing.
Okay.
So, how do we behave when we hear that? I mean, how do we behave when something jumps out at us, or when suddenly there's a car on the highway where we didn't see one earlier? When there's a knock at the door when we're not expecting someone.
Well, you don't pause to sit there and deliberate, right?
Right.
Like, say, oh, okay, what rationally is going on here?
Because you can basically make two types of errors in cognition here. You can make what is called a type one error or a false positive. And this is when you believe something is real when it is not. So this is, for instance, a friend jumps out at you in a monster costume. And you realize, oh, it's just a monster costume. It's not a monster. But you react initially like it's a monster, mm-hmm. and maybe punch them or apply a few karate chops. Now, and then there's a type two error in cognition, and this is a false negative. And this is believing something is not real when it is. So this is when a monster jumps out at you, and you think it's your friend in a monster mask, and you're like, hey, buddy, you need to go like for a high five, and then you get eaten.
Right. That's a scenario that not so good.
Right. So as you can see, the type two error in cognition, the false negative, that is the scenario most likely to result in death if you're dealing with some sort of surprise that could be fatal.
Okay, so it makes sense that you put a lot more stock in the type one. Like, people
right.
would probably be more willing to make that error than the type two.
Yeah, the type one error, it's like worst case scenario type one error is you just feel kind of stupid because you were scared by something that wasn't real.
Yeah.
Type two, worst case scenario, you were eaten by a monster. So, which do you think, nature selects for? Which do you think has proven the evolutionary advantage? The type one.
Right.
That is the default error with the human mind.
Okay.
So take that situation with your friend in the monster mask, then extrapolate that to civilization-wide, events and to large human-created systems and perceived systems. So the idea that a meteorite could hit the earth and destroy everybody, we're incredibly likely to make a type one error and prepare for the worst there. And then that breaks down in the spiritual and mythic realm as well.
Yeah.
We often end up making this type one error where we're more likely to believe the imagined thing because if it doesn't come to pass, well, we just feel a little foolish. Then we laugh, right? And as we've discussed in the past, that's where we get the whole benign violation theory of laughter and humor. The idea that when we realize that something that we thought was a threat isn't real,
uh-huh.
after we have made that type one error, we just go, ah, ha, ha. And that's our way of letting everyone around us know that that was just a dude in a monster mask and not an actual monster.
Right, right. You get the release,
right.
you know, regardless. So speaking of benign violation theory, And you having brought up the article that you wrote about how to deal with an apocalypse or several different types of apocalypses.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about zombie apocalypse.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So this is an interesting one that instantly comes to mind because it's everywhere. The zombie thing will not die no matter how many shots it takes. Yeah, it just keeps crawling and lurching and sometimes running ahead. So we have things like The Walking Dead on TV is
mm-hmm.
Season two premiered and it was like huge. Everybody was watching it. I mean, you just look around you. Zombies are everywhere. And why? It's another apocalyptic scenario,
mm-hmm.
not one that most of anyone really believes in unless zombies are somehow tied into your particular religious view of the rapture. And, you know, maybe it is. But for the most part, this is like a purely fictional idea that we're just
right.
obsessed with. We like the part of our brains that love apocalypse and are more likely to buy into apocalypse, we can't help but think about this scenario. And I think it's really interesting to sort of break down why that is. Chuck Klosterman had a bit, I believe this came out last year, around the same time that the first season of The Walking Dead came out. And he had some interesting thoughts in his article, My Zombie, Myself, Why Modern Life Feels Rather Undead. And he said, every zombie war is a war of attrition. It's always a numbers game, and it's more repetitive than complex. In other words, zombie killing is philosophically similar to reading and deleting 400 work emails on a Monday morning or filling out paperwork that only generates more paperwork or following Twitter gossip out of obligation or performing tedious tasks in which the only true risk is being consumed by the avalanche. The principal downside to any zombie attack is that the zombies will never stop coming. The principal downside to life is that you will never be finished with whatever it is you do. So that was his kind of take on why the modern audience is so into the zombie idea. My own thinking about it, because I find zombies interesting, even if the idea is a little played out at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't help but think a large part of it is because the zombie is the... In the same way that apocalypse scenarios appeal to us on kind of a liberation frontiersman
mm-hmm.
Standpoint, and you know that's like, oh, the world comes to an end, and now it's just me and my survival skills against nature.
Right.
And even though that's a battle that most of us are not prepared for at all,
mm-hmm.
Or we're certainly not as prepared for as we might think we would be. There's something romantic about it, you know? It's kind of like that whole, what if I were to leave everything I own and just drive off into the sunset?
Well, and it's a safe place to play out your fears, right?
Right.
Because talking about benign violation theory, I mean, you have zombies, you probably can outrun them, right?
Right.
And, even though, probably for every 5 you kill, there's another 10 that pop up like a Hydra head, much like Chuck Klosterman was saying with emails. You know, it's something that, that you can still battle against. It's not the real apocalypse.
Right. And the zombies themselves, I mean, so many of the things that we fear in modern life are rather ethically complex. Like the idea, like even if it's something as simple as crime or terrorism, well, mm-hmm. I mean, not, these are not simple, but these, is an example like crime or terrorism, for example, those are complex, situations. And you can't just, but with zombies, it's rather simple. The zombie is an undead monster, and if it comes at you, you can shoot it in the head, or you can hit it with a baseball bat, and then wham, one part of that problem is solved. Life is rarely as simple as that. So there's, I think there's a fantasy in your life becoming that kind of conflict, where there's a clear-cut solution,
yeah.
And, well, I mean, and for some people, I mean, there's something attractive about the idea that violence is that kind of a solution.
Well, it's ethical killing, right?
Yeah.
Because they're already dead. And, I mean, you're just trying to survive, right?
Yeah, you
and,
can sort of, like, walk the masculine war dog inside you without actually having to feast yourself on scenes of human violence and deprivation.
Yeah, or as a feminist, you can take up arms and
right.
battle against zombies and go on to sustain life
yeah.
for the human race.
Yeah, and you don't have to worry with all these ethical concerns of murder and self-defense.
So I don't know. I'm sure you're aware of this, but in Atlanta and other cities, there is going to be a zombie 5K, I believe, in February.
I'd forgotten about that, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So are you going to shamble in it?
No,
are
I don't
fast
know
zombies
because
or slow zombies?
That was my question because I was like, is this 28 days later zombies where they're, you know, they're able to learn and they get really fast? Because I really don't want someone to tackle me and start drooling brains or fake brains all over me.
Yeah.
I know that's weird for that to be bothersome, but I don't mind if they're just kind of shuffling after me.
Huh.
That could be fun.
Well, they do a walk here every year, or they have for the last several years, where like a bunch of people will gather in zombie makeup, generally on like a Friday afternoon. So it's, I mean, I've never.
Is this different from the Little Five Points Parade?
Yes, this is different.
Okay.
This Little Five Points Parade is a cool little local Halloween parade that we have that's that I hope to go to again this year. It's kind of disorganized, but not like zombie disorganized.
It's pretty wonderful, actually.
It's pretty wonderful. That's what makes it so wonderful. It's kind of disorganized. It's
yeah.
not like this hugely thought out parade that it just and it's not like just. You know, spontaneous either. It's,
yeah.
There's some degree of planning, but it's pretty loose and fun.
It's like legions of zombies and pirates and
yeah.
all sorts.
But the zombie walk is something slightly different where people dress up as zombies and sort of shamble across town on an afternoon. But
okay. Well, so Holly Fry of Pop Stuff
yeah.
is actually training for the, well, she's a runner, but she's training for this 5K.
Oh, is she?
So we'll get an update, I'm sure, pretty soon on the zombie 5K.
That explains all those questionable lunches she's been having, you know?
Yes, well, she's preparing
very
herself,
gray and
you know?
With bits of human hair stuck in them.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. And you thought it was some sort of like vestigial cafe of delights.
Yeah, the vestigial cafe just opened up down the street. It's the newest thing with the foodies and hipsters.
Yeah, you can get some sort of like tumor with a tooth in it.
Ugh,
sorry. But hey, I mean, it's Halloween-ish, so
yeah,
we can talk about
well, yeah,
this kind of stuff.
Post-Halloween. People are still riding high on it.
I want to leave this conversation with a quote, if I may.
Okay.
This is from New Scientist and talking about the apocalypse and why it's important to people. It says, the apocalyptic visions also help us make sense of an often seemingly senseless world. In the face of confusion and annihilation, we need restitution and reassurance. We want to feel that no matter how chaotic, oppressive, or evil the world is, all will be made right in the end. The apocalypse as history's end is made acceptable with a belief that there will be a new beginning. The psychology
Excellent.
Behind it.
Awesome.
In a nice pithy paragraph.
Well, speaking of new beginnings, I'm going to reach inside the listener mail bag now, and I'm going to retrieve a particular email from listener Mike that deals with Red Bull, or more specifically, the idea of Southeast Asian Red Bull. Because I mentioned in a previous podcast about how when I was in Thailand, I mm-hmm. had a Thai Red Bull and how it was like a totally different experience than American Red Bull. It was sweeter. It was insanely like powerful. It like you felt your eyes do that Incredible Hulk thing when you drank it. And
this just sounds like some sort of hashish drink.
Yeah, it was
green
weird.
Green fatties.
I don't know what was in it. But I asked listeners, like, hey, has anyone else had this experience, or did I buy a tainted Red Bull and just had a weird experience with it? Well, Mike writes in, and he says, hey, guys, I'm 15 and a big fan. I heard Robert talking about the Thai Red Bull and had a very Lost-esque flashback. This summer, my mom and dad and I took a two-week trip to Cambodia, very cool, to be with some missionary friends and help out with their hospital, even cooler. Red Bull was everywhere in Cambodia. We were pretty close to the border of Thailand. I bought some of it in a little 8-ounce can, and it was definitely how Robert described it. It was much sweeter, and it was uncarbonated. Fantastic stuff. I'll include a picture of it so you guys can see if any of the cans look alright. Like, was the Red Bull in the medicine bottle carbonated? Okay, so I looked at the picture, and it looks different from what I had, but it's been several years, so who knows, the branding may have changed, and also Cambodian Red Bull might be slightly different from Thai Red Bull, I don't know. But I have a suspicion that the chemicals were very similar.
It's possible. I have heard that Coke in Mexico is far different from Coke in the United States.
Yeah,
it's
well,
actually
the sugar
much better.
Thing, right? Yeah, yeah, it's like it's made with real sugar versus a high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
And I don't remember if it was carbonated. I just remember that I felt carbonated after I drank it. And we have a couple of other emails here I'm going to go through real quick. Paul writes in from Australia. Says, good day, it's Paul from Australia, where about the only thing that won't kill you is our weird tiny stingless bees. Anyway, I've been listening with rapt enjoyment since episode one and have wanted to comment on almost every topic covered. I spend many hours each day driving, and I usually listen in large batches, however, and have just never gotten around to it. So I put down my panda sandwich with its side order of popcorn cicadas, popped a few gummy bears in my mouth instead, wiped my mind clear, chased out the devil and his fiendish dubstep, and wrote this of what I can only assume is my own free will. I had an interesting moment whilst listening to the podcast on memory when Julie was reading out the list. When she came to the test words and read the trick word sweet, I quickly raced through my memory palace, noticed that sweet wasn't there, and immediately drew an uppercase Q on my forehead, tail on the left, of course. Oops, gotta go. My larval humans are whining about saber-tooths on the subway again, and you know how annoying that can be. I'll write again soon if I get enough of a dopamine hit from this. Later, Paul. P.S. Lady Gaga.
I love that.
Wow, yeah, he was able to wrap so many references in.
I think he just covered like about 100 podcasts in there. Or yeah, at least, maybe, I don't know, maybe 60 or so. Nicely done, Paul. That's yes, going up in my cubicle.
Yes, I like the way this man's mind works. Here's another one from Timothy. Timothy writes in, Robert and Julie, thank you for this podcast. It's funny that you mentioned how social stimulation helps fuel creativity during this episode. He's talking about splendid isolation. Because that is exactly what the simulated social interaction of listening to your podcast did for me. Please allow me to explain. I've had a book floating around in my head for a decade or so, and have never really mustered the creative energy to write, as opposed to the dozens of other projects I find myself involved in. Amazingly, your description of social isolation and its effects were identical to the major themes of the story, and completely validated my creative instincts. That encouraging knowledge gave me a vivid image of the characters I haven't captured for a long time. Thanks again, I now know how to find my inspiration in the real-life drama of psychology. And that was again from Tim. So that's awesome. I love it when we hear accounts of how our listeners have taken something or that we've covered and have managed to turn that into some new creative energy or some new inspiration in their creative life. So,
yeah, I love that too.
Yeah.
I always think that there are so many different novels that could come from some of the research that we do.
Yes, yes. I think basically there's a best-selling novel in every episode. And I just hope that the people who write those best-selling novels and option the screenplay, did they just remember you and I? And
that's right.
And just, you know, float us a few bucks when the millions roll in.
Or, you know, just...
treat us to a dinner. I don't know.
I was going to say a nice postcard.
Yeah, or look at one of those cheese baskets. Well, I would... you don't eat cheese, but... you can send me the cheese basket when the screenplay is an option for sure. Hey, so if you have anything you would like to share with us, the first stop would be Twitter and Facebook. We're on both of those as Blow the Mind. We regularly update those feeds with cool links, tidbits about what we're doing, and we'd love to hear from you.
And you can always get in touch with us by sending an email to blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.